This episode, I'm joined once again by William C. Hackett to discuss the work of Stanislas Breton, alongside discussions on Neoplatonism, phenomenology, and more. I'd like to thank all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you'd like to support the podcast or gain access to some exclusive content, please find links in the description for Patreon below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Chris Hackett, thanks very much once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
My pleasure.
So, at the end of our last conversation with John Vahl, I usually ask most of my guests, new guests, I say, look, is there anyone that you're knowledgeable about who you feel has been, you know, overlooked or maybe completely ignored? And you mentioned the man whose work we'll be talking about today, Stanislas Breton, who in English, we have two books. We have The Word and the Cross and A Radical Philosophy of St. Paul, both of which I read. And then I found little bits here and there. And I guess to open up this conversation, I found this fantastic quotation. And then from this, I'll ask you to just jump in with, you know, the history and the biography and where we situate him. But this brilliant quotation, cool, which I think is from, I think I got it from Radical Philosophy of St. Paul. And it goes, it says, Stanislas Breton, constructive philosopher, critical theologian, contemplative, amateur mathematician, phenomenologist, metaphysician, Neoplatonist, trained in a Baroque-style scholasticism, spent Saturday mornings reading late antique pagan authors with major Neoplatonic scholars, a Catholic priest, associated with Louis Althusser, highly technical treatises on Thomism, Phenomenology, and Neoplatonism, and alongside monographs on Aquinas, Hartmann, Spinoza, Proclus, Cyrin and Eckhart, and St. Paul. And lo and behold, this man has been forgotten. But I thought it was a fantastic single paragraph shotgun blast of what we're diving into.
Yes. Yeah, it's exactly right. He's in that sense, quite eclectic. Quite eclectic. But he's not one of those eclectic thinkers who is a mile wide and an inch deep. He's richly invested in the in theology, in the Christian tradition. He's practicing. You know, he's a priest. He's he has a really strong devotion, in particular to the cross, which I think when the text you read really comes out. And but he's also just, his mind is just one in which he is restless, and he's finding connections. He's exploring anything that follows his interests. He's wide open, and there's no contradiction there at all. And he's in his person.
Mm-hmm. So where did you come across his work?
That's a good question. I did my philosophical studies in continental thought, what we call continental philosophy. So, and French contemporary, modern and contemporary French philosophy is really my field. So Breton's right there in the middle, and particularly the guy, kind of interest that I had with the French Catholic Neoplatonists, and who are also phenomenologists, is sort of those two. You see that overlaps in Breton's work too, but he's one among a few, a handful of brilliant French intellectuals who are very interested in phenomenology, Neoplatonism, and theology.
The French Catholics always end up going towards phenomenology.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's the Neoplatonist angle? From what I could garner from him, from what I could gather about his biography, he really begins with, just as a passionate Christian, quite literally a passionist.
Yeah,
right?
Passionist. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. He joins the Passionist Order when he's ordained in 1936. By the way, he has such an interesting biography. I hope we can talk about that some, because it really is, you know, Nietzsche said that all philosophy is autobiography. Mm-hmm. And whereas, you know, Heidegger has sort of the opposite view, of course.
Heidegger would want to say that though, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Convenient. Right. Well, in Breton's case, to understand his thinking, it's not a disembodied, it's enfleshed, fully enfleshed, fully communal, fully human thought in the world. And it's very much part of his biography. To really understand his thinking, we do have to talk about his biography. But you're right, the Neoplatonism comes after, it's like a second, I hesitate to use this phrase because it's much more than that, the Neoplatonism is, but it's like a second turn in his thinking. You know, he's his earliest interests, his formation is really in that Baroque style, like the Baroque style scholastic Thomism. You know, just abstract, huge systems, distinctions and concepts all ordered. And I think that that's always fascinated him. I think he's gifted at mathematics, abstractions, and the relations. Relations are really a key word for Breton. Abstractions and their relations, and kind of the unfolding of a thought from a single idea, like a presupposition in which things sort of unfold. And I think that's something that's always fascinated him. That's his earliest formation. That's right there in, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas's thought, thinking, and the way in which the influence St. Thomas's thought had in, or let's say, you know, in during his era of formation, the sort of what they call the Leonine Thomism, this manual style scholastic formation, was very much his own. He didn't stay there. Like, we put that restless sort of mind, kind of like St. Augustine type mind, just expansive, but also full of passion. There's that word again, full of passion for learning and understanding. It's very much a part of Breton's life. So the phenomenology is sort of second after the scholastic formation, and in his day, in his place and time. So, you know, talking about, so you could say phenomenology sort of founded in 1900 with a certain set of writings of Husserl's. Mm-hmm. And it becomes, you know, the dominant form of philosophy in the 20th century, particularly in France. And it's in the water he's drinking, it's in the air. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of like Neoplatonism was for St. Augustine, or Dionysius the Areopagite, Pseudo-Dionysius, or any of the other patristic thinkers we could talk about. It's just the intellectual atmosphere. Mm. Phenomenology is what that was for him there.
I'm not sure the Continentals have got beyond phenomenology yet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Maybe. No, I don't know. Maybe you disagree. I mean, you get all the Derrida people, right? Thinking.
Well, Derrida's so deeply informed by phenomenology. I think exactly. there's you know, philosophical anthropology kind of figures coming out of Blumenberg, who there's all these movements, strong movement to critique phenomenology. Mm. I would still say that phenomenology is a very strong influence, particularly in France. Mm. But there's also competing programs as well, mm-hmm. as there have always been. Mm-hmm. But Heidegger's influence, Husserl and Heidegger, had such a deep influence on French thought after the war, the Second World War.
So, phenomenology, the history of phenomenology in this period, 1912 to 2005, which is just it's really odd to think about someone living that era. Like, it ends in 2005, which seems like yesterday, right? Like, Breton could have possibly...
I know. He's our contemporary. Yeah.
Could he have seen Facebook, you know, kind of thing? It's like, you know what I mean? It's a strange mixture of...
That is weird. I never thought that.
Exactly. It's like Jean Baudrillard could have seen Wally, right? I realized the other day, Heidegger could have watched Easy Rider. Like, I don't want to think about these things. It really weirds me out.
It is weird. Weird is the right word. That's the way we see this.
But there's something about... I don't think that's as sort of biographically fluffy as I realized, because in 1912, I think when we're talking about serious scholastic attempts with Neo-Thomism, I guess it would be Neoplatonism and phenomenology, it is almost like that already in 2022 feels like a different world.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't feel modern anymore at all.
Uh-huh. Or contemporary. Yeah. Right. It does. Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. No, I agree. There's a few things we could think about that, but I think the main point is that his he had this early formation, and which was very Thomist, and he wrote his autobiography, intellectual autobiography, is called De Rome à Paris, from Rome to Paris, and that sort of represents that move, that intellectual move, you know, from Rome, which is just heavily dominated. Intellectual life in Rome is dominated by these Roman universities, in which for the formation of Catholic priests, and these really old, you know, huge edifice type buildings, you know, full of people training. He's teaching. He was trained there. He taught there. He makes a move back to France, and that geographical move, he doesn't, in his thinking, he's not leaving behind something, but he's expanding something. He's deepening something. He's just like Thomas Aquinas in that sense. Thomas Aquinas is one and there's this huge expansive interest. He's willing to go all the way with this new philosophy of rediscovered philosophy of Aristotle. Similarly, Breton, there's this sort of Catholic small c universal drive to unity, but also to expansiveness. And those two movements of the mind are very much together, you know, in Breton. So that move to it's a huge move, intellectual move. I mean, it's also a huge sociological move. You know, you're moving out of from this circles of these influences with these figures who do the, you know, and you're moving to something completely new. And they are sort of it. They're competing for dominance in a way, and for the intellectual, for intellectual vision, you know, and a method as well. And for him, it's always for him, it's a break, but it's also continuity. I think every break has continuity for Breton. You know, it's like a religious, it's analogous to a religious experience or a conversion in which there's a massive break, but it's also a continuity. It's a deepening. It's an intensification of what you're seeking and so on.
So does he see himself, you know, in direct discussion with the other, you know, I mean, this trio in a way of Catholicism, Thomism, phenomenology is a key thing in this era. Does he see himself in discussion with, you know, I mean, one figure, most notably Edith Stein, or does the Neoplatonism come in and veer him off in a different direction altogether?
I think that the Neoplatonism, so if you have a turn to phenomenology from out of scholasticism, I mean, I think the bridge that links those two, for example, we'll get to the next in a second, but the bridge that links those two for him is this concept of relation, essayad, being towards. And he finds that in the works of Thomas. Any text you look at, you're looking at things that some things pop out and other things fade to the background, you know, and you prioritize certain concepts. Well, he prioritizes this idea of relation. That sort of sets it on the tee for him. It prepares the ground for him to understand phenomenology in a certain way, of intentionality, of this relation directed mode or meaning of consciousness. There's certainly continuity there. With Neoplatonism, it was like the metaphor is here. It's like a bomb, an intellectual bomb explodes for him. It's like, you know, the lights turn on. It's like radical stuff he's super excited about, like completely over the moon by Neoplatonism. Like, you know, it's something that he becomes obsessed with.
So Neoplatonism sort of historically has become quite a big, not necessarily a mess, but the history of Neoplatonism is people taking Neoplatonists and then they almost become Neoplatonists, if you see what I mean. So you begin with Plotinus, Proclus, Iamblichus. And then you have also like the Ficino Pico era, but then like they're now considered Neoplatonists, even though, so you see what I mean? So what school of Neoplatonism is he?
Ooh. Yeah.
Is that a tough question? Well,
that's a great question. You know, I think it is right to think about Neoplatonism in terms of schools. It's also right to think about Neoplatonism. And this is why I think he's so important, is that he helps us see more clearly that Neoplatonism, this is not original to me, this phrase, but that Neoplatonism is the spiritual grammar of the West. I don't remember who said that.
It's nice.
Yeah, it's awesome. You find it in Latin Christian thought. Mm-hmm. You find it in Greek Christian thought. Mm-hmm. You find it in Renaissance. It's sort of recovered. When the writings of Plato and other Greek thinkers, the Platonists, Neoplatonism, by the way, is a 19th century word. Plotinus thought of himself as a Platonist. Mm-hmm. He thought, you know, what he's doing is systematizing the thought of Plato by reading through the dialogues and representing that. And he's also a synthetic, massively synthetic thinker. Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics, he philosophy is one for him, and its ambition is unified and also universal. And it's a synthetic mode. And what synthesizes it, and this is why Breton's so interested, is, for lack of a better word, the mystical, the union of the mystical and the intellectual. And that's you know, it's a mystical philosophy. For Breton, mysticism is a really important part of his biography, because through the trials that he suffered through the war, the way he sort of came back to life, he you know, had this sort of 10-year recovery. He had these two near-death experiences, I think you read about, in which he's despairing of life and survives, like, you know, survives a plane crash that catches on fire and breaks in half next to his seat. He's like one of the few survivors as he's being rescued from 5 years in prison in POW camp, in which he's throws his, you know, the manuscript he's working on in the river because he's despairing of his life because the bombs are flying around about him. Russians are bombing the Germans and so on. He has this turn to mystical authors that helps him recover like basic motor functions and balance that he had lost through this horrific experience. So the mystics are really important to him, I guess is what I mean. And he finds this unit. He's a cerebral guy, very smart, very intellectual, fascinated by abstraction, conceptual relation, implications of ideas and how they unfold. But he also has this deep piety and spirituality and this deep sort of rich sense of the world and its goodness and beauty.
So in this
and all that's in Neoplatonism that he thinks it's, well, this is sheds light on all this, these aspects of who he is.
So in the sense that you said about Neoplatonism being the grammar of the West philosophical, the difference then between, like, you know, I would ask the question, why is Neoplatonism and not Platonism the grammar? Uh-huh. With Neoplatonism, you have the unification of the intellect and the mystical, whereas perhaps in Platonism, over time, the mystical elements which were there have been a bit stripped away, a bit pulled back, or pushed away.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that Plato has sort of been, you know, the Plato you get in Philosophy 101 in the university. I mean, Plato is such a much more profound figure than that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a mysticism in Plato, to be sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mysticism in Plato. There's, you know, a value of the physical world in Plato and it's in the way in which it can awaken you to the highest and best things. He's got this phrase that becomes really important for Plotinus at the sort of apex of his thought, which is that the good is beyond being. The good is beyond being, epicanitas ousias, in the Republic. That is a key feature of this idea of the principle of the Neoplatonic one, the ineffable, the goal of thinking, the goal of living and of breathing and of doing is all about, well, to use Plotinus's words, return to the one. Return to the one. And Plato has a very similar sensibility that the good, this idea, this reality behind that is a condition for things to be. It precedes being. Goodness. That's why Plato gets up in the morning. There's a really profound mysticism and mystical dimension in Plato. I know mysticism and mystical, I mean, you can kind of, these are terms with a life and a history, but I hope we're sort of indicating what's happening there. Something richly human, something deeply meaningful. And so the kind of Neoplatonism that Breton, what school is he in? He's in the, how could you put it? I mean, he's attracted to Proclus in particular.
Mm.
Proclus was a mind like his, very capable systematically, conceptually, and abstractly, and seeing how things unfold from fundamental principles. Proclus was also, he's in that stream of what we call now theurgic Neoplatonism, coming from Iamblichus, that's opposed to that of Porphyry, the student of Plotinus. They had these sort of, I mean, you can overdo this distinction of schools in the pagan Neoplatonic stream. But that's the Proclus is the Neoplatonist who most directly, and I mean, when I say directly, I mean, whole pages of Proclus are just sort of rewritten a little bit and found in the works of the Pseudo Dionysius.
Mm-hmm.
Proclus is the one who deeply informed Christianity in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
So Neoplatonism, I think to think about the Neoplatonism of Breton adequately, I do think we have to follow a Canadian scholar named Wayne Hanke, who talks about the Renaissance of Neoplatonism in France in the 20th century. It's one of the key ways to understand what's happening intellectually in France is this Renaissance of Neoplatonism from that sort of defines the 20th century of French thought. And that phenomenology is deeply intertwined with that. And the Catholic intellectuals who are phenomenologists, quite most of them, are deeply informed by this kind of Neoplatonic revival. So I think contemporaries like Jean-Luc Marion and some of his fellows.
I was going to say, what other figures are we seeing, you know, in this new Neoplatonic revival? Who else is in this discussion?
Oh, goodness. Michel Henry, Jean-Luc Marion. The guys that he studies on Saturday mornings, Breton meets with for Saturday morning reading group. And they go to
Cum Turia Dumare.
Yep. And all those guys are priests, Catholic priests. All four of them meeting together are reading the texts of pagan Neoplatonists from like the, you know, fifth, sixth centuries, and doing incredible scholarship. If you read this, it's a very long text of Wayne Hankins, but I can't recommend it enough to get a real sense. And all these major names that you'll see in that are sort of lined up and explicated as part of this, what he again calls the Neoplatonic revival. It's a long, long essay, and it's full of names, but it's full of name, French names, important names, especially if you're, and a lot of them are Catholic thinkers, in the 20th century French thought, and Breton's in the middle of it. So the phenomenology, the Neoplatonism that he's gets the, and the Neoplatonism, by the way, is what he's invited to teach by Althusser at the Ecole Normale. He's invited to give a lecture. I don't know how they met, and then they hit it off. And then I think Breton is one. I never met him personally, but I think Breton is one of those guys in whom, if you meet this person, you hit it off with him. He's just completely likable, affable, full of great conversationalist, interested in everything. You know, you can just imagine. He's just a little man that's always a huge smile. And that's the way he's been described by like Richard Carney, for example, who I've talked with about him. Who, by the way, that interview of Carney with Breton from Word and the Cross and appended to the back, fantastic intro. Your readers, I mean, your listeners, I think that's a great place to start with Breton. It's biographical, talks some of his major ideas, influences, and so on.
So Althusser and Breton,
yes.
You know, they hit it off, but what's the history there? Because that's after everything we've said already, if you then said, well, close associate of Althusser, sort of at the height of Althusser's fame, as well as a scholar. There's this passionist Neoplatonist Catholic amidst the ranks.
Yes. And not only that, but he's a devoted friend of Althusser's through the 80s, like the darkest times for Althusser. You know, after he murders his wife and he goes mad, you know, and has this sort of, you know, breakdown after breakdown. He's there meeting with him like once a week. And he wrote a sort of reflection about their meetings. It's called Althusser and Religion. And it's been translated into English. It's a nice reflection, but I'll probably read something from that if we get further into the Marxism stuff, because I think it'll help illuminate a little bit about what Breton's, because he was interested in Marxist critique. Marxist critique, not in Marxism, but in Marxist critique he was interested in, and he thought it was valuable. You know, so anyway, so he's invited by Althusser to give a lecture. Hegel and the Neoplatonists is the lecture. He does so well that Althusser said, I want you to become maître de conférence, sort of like invited assistant professor, to come teach a class every semester or every year at the Ecole Normale Supérieure, which is like the center of intellectual formation in France. He does that. I think it's from 70 to 75. He does that you're invited back every time. Jean Val, for example, had the same sort of post position at the Ecole Normale. If you have another position somewhere else, and then you also can go and do this sort of prestigious thing. So Breton was the first Catholic priest to do that. Because earlier, Catholic priests weren't allowed to be employed by the state.
So he was obviously in the Passionist order. Then during all this intellectual formation, was he still practicing as a priest, or was that something that had been?
Yeah. No, okay. He's too. I mean, you read Word on the Cross, you read A Radical Philosophy of St. Paul. He's very, his vocation is the word, you know, the Catholic word, the religious word that's used. His vocation is very much, he's deeply integrated with that life. All of his mind, his soul, his actions in the world, and the way he thinks about everything is deeply informed. Like it's stamped through and through. It's suffused with that passionist way of being and a priestly mode of being. You know, the evangelical power, you know, councils, celibacy, not getting married, you know, living at the margins of society, the way it's sort of, and which for him gives a certain freedom, certain freedom to be in a unique manner, in like proto eschatological way, on the edge of existence, where you're like free to, I don't know, imitate Christ in the world kind of thing. That's very much a part of who he is. And it only deepens through his life. It's not something that he loses through all of his intellectual escapades and all these different things, Marxism, you know, Neoplatonism, mathematics, all of that is just one for him. And it's, he says that he goes into philosophy by way of theology, and he goes into theology by way of his vocation, his priestly vocation, his calling, his purpose in the world, as he understands it. So it's all, the continuity is really important, I think, in understanding him. So you can't think about Breton and Marxism without framing it by his, I don't know, for lack of a better word, his religious, mystical, vocational sensibility. And it's all centered on what the cross means to him. The cross. And the cross is like the center of passionist spirituality. You know, contemplating that symbol, that event, you know, that turning point in history and all that.
So I guess we've got a big foundation of biography there and his place in the history of Western philosophy. But as you've mentioned it, you know, I'll just open up his philosophy, I guess, trying to do what Breton himself does, taking one small thing and then drawing it out. What does the cross mean to Breton? Could we begin to understand his philosophy, which from what I could get my hands on, I understood as a philosophy, which is always grasping at what we could maybe consider harmony, unity, synthesis. So if we were to begin from the cross.
Yes. Now, this is the whole thing. This is all Breton here. This is, you've got the very heart of his thinking. And it has a theological dimension, but not merely. And I think this is really important to understand, you know, Breton's total outlook on life, his total person, but also his understanding of everything from mathematics to walking the dog to, you know, Marxism to Neoplatonism. It's all sort of revolves around, like constellated around this, or it all orbits around this symbol. But not merely a symbol, but I mean, like when I say symbol, I mean this, you know, two lines crossing. He contemplates that all the time. The cross, theologically or religiously, for him, gosh, the words I'm using are just not apt for it, but it's a mystical symbol. You know, I think for him, it's not, when I say not merely a symbol, it's the center of his faith that Christ died on, was crucified. You know, and rises on the third day. But as a symbol, its meaning, I guess his thinking is about explicating the meaning of that for everything he thinks about, which is quite literally everything. And it religiously and theologically, and this is not isolated from the mystical for Breton, what the cross does for him, its meaning or significance is total. Okay. And because he's attempting to be a Christian, its meaning and significance is that it brings, as he, in his own language, it brings the new God to speech. So when he writes the logos of the cross, the word of the cross, it brings the new God, a new understanding of God, a new understanding of God to, into the world. It has a logos, it has a meaning, and that's what the cross reveals. So it collapses the understanding, the former ways of understanding God. You know, it's a crucified Jew. It also opens, and I think he's pursuing this his whole life, a new way of understanding God. And I think he considers himself a sort of disciple of St. Paul. mean, his baptismal name is Paul. It's before he became Stanislaus, his religious name. You become in the Passionists, you go and enter a religious order in the Catholic, often you take on a new name. That's Stanislaus. His name before that was Paul. And it's kind of interesting to read A Radical Philosophy of St. Paul, by the way, knowing that he conceives himself as a sort of intimate disciple of St. Paul, who, and that's why he writes these books that are reflecting on Pauline writings, you know, the word of the cross is foolishness and all that. Which, by the way, if you opened up, if you looked at the Office of Readings for the church today, you would find this passage that he writes about, 1 Corinthians from the letter of St. Paul. You would find the word of the cross is foolishness and so on. It's the reading for today for today. So sort of constellations, nice synthesis there. But the cross for Baton in the first place means it brings the new God to speech, a new way of conceiving God, that ultimately is defined and articulated in Trinitarian mode and incarnation and all that. As the church thinks about that, it also, in that activity, it puts to death for Breton our ideological constructs. I guess the religious word would be something like the idols we have, our idolatry. And so it's putting something to death, and it's also opening a new way of seeing God, but also therefore understanding what we are and understanding what it means to live well in the world. That's why he's a philosopher. So that's the sort of heart of it. I think that it brings the new God to speech, and it, in doing that, it demolishes our ideological constructs, our ambitions to capture God or capture God as an object, by our thinking. And a lot of what his criticisms about scholastic tradition is its sort of ossification into a system that's sort of dry and desiccate and sort of becomes like an ideological construct. That's where he thinks critique is really important.
That's a serious task he's taking on there to keep.
It's
practical. It's beyond at the same time as being practical. It's passionate.
It's mystical.
But it can't be drawn into being a system because he doesn't want to let the actual, literally, once again, the passion of the cross to die. All in one act.
It's keeping that flame alive. That's right. Yeah.
Which seems oddly humble.
Yeah. I would say that's true. I would say that's true about it is. There's an oddity about the whole thing. There's an oddity about, I think he wants to recover the oddity of Christianity. It's the way in which it is sort of in conflict with the, you know, they call it the world. It's in conflict with it. It runs in a different, according beats, it runs, moves according to the beat of a different drum.
And, do you think maybe he saw that at the time that, you know, there would be a difference between Catholicism in practice and passion, and Catholicism as almost like a discussion partner in philosophy, right? Oh, they're the Catholic philosophers. Like it's just a thing. Oh, they're Hegelian, they're Deleuzean, they're whatever. Oh, they're Catholic philosophers. Like, as soon as you do that, you've subsumed it into that same language. It's sort of died out.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think on the other hand, he does see the value and the importance of, you know, that conceptualization, the utilization of theory, and in short, philosophy, because concept and theory are where philosophy happens, of theological activity, like systematization. All of that, I think he does see the real value of, but he wants it to be governed by this ever greater critical principle, this inescapable, it's this idea of transcendence that captivates, but is always, it's like the carrot, the intellectual, the carrot in front of the mind. It's always reaching forward, it's opening up, you know, further away. It's unfolding. And, you know, it's kind of like Jean Val's conception of transcendence, which has those two dimensions, the transcendent reality, but also the movement of transcending, and if it, which can never come to an end, or transcendence disappears, you know, so you have, it's like the immanence and transcendence idea, the sort of, somehow these two, presence is not a presence like an object, divine presence is not like the presence of a thing. It's actually an absence. It exceeds the difference between absence and presence. It's like an absent presence. It's like a, you know, it's much more profound understanding. And in talking like that, we're reaching this sort of taking this, or you could call an apophatic trail, and sort of negation, you're sort of transcending your ideas of the principle. So it's humble in the sense that it's aware of that we're always lisping, we're always, our thought is always fragmentary, our systems are always fragile. And that's a wonderful thing because it means they can't capture. It's not like Hegel, you know, where everything's captured, or at least one interpretation of
Oh
Hegel.
yeah, I was going to ask that. I mean, how does Breton, do you think, stop that sort of continual expanse of the beyond becoming almost like eating itself? You know, becoming you could quite quickly just fall into some sort of strange nihilism. The beyond remains oddly, the beyond for Breton appears and feels to remain quite stable.
I see what you're saying. And I think that the real danger in the apophatic tradition or negative the tradition, the Neoplatonic mystical tradition, which is one way of understanding it, at least from the 3rd century in Plotinus to the 6th century in Damasius, that pagan tradition, the sort of assumed and taken over, the reins are taken over by Christianity once it kind of dies out, is that it's an attempt to be more and more faithful to the radicality of the principle, the transcendence that they're always pushing to purifying, I guess is the traditional word. They're purifying their conceptions of transcendence. You have the one in Plotinus, then you have, you know, then they'll start talking about the one beyond the one or the ineffable, and then the ineffable behind the ineffable. You know, there's the sense that you can never reach it. And but it's like Augustine's phrase, "Oh God, you are closer to me than I am to myself. I can never reach you because you're more me than I am. You're closer to me than I am to myself. You're to reach myself, I already passed through this interval that you are. You know, you're the it's like God is like this absent presence again. You know, so you have this mystical sense of everything in this Neoplatonic tradition. And you have that. That's a danger of this tradition. And thinking about Breton, I don't know. I think where Breton returns is probably like the stories in the Gospels. You know, it's like this is the place where to understand the cross, we have these texts about this man, and then we have the texts of his earliest followers that have some sort of authoritative or influence on how we are meant to understand the empty tomb, this cross, and then the empty tomb. Like, what's the significance of that? What we Christians call the Triduum, you know, this 3-day event at the center of the Christian faith. And I think for Breton, it's there's a lot to say there. One of the things you could say is that I think he turns to these stories that make sense of this absence. He says the emptiness of the tomb is the original source where Christian thinking as a critical thinking emerges. There's this absence there. God, you know, Christ ascends to heaven. He's not here. His presence is in a different mode. It's an absent presence in a way. It eclipses the distinction between, you know, the way in which, you know, I hold this pen out in front of you and then I move it by my back. It's absent visually to you. It's there's something greater happening. It's a divine mode of being that is possessed. I think that that's sort of the religious side, the way in which he wants to temper the radicality. Not and it's not merely tempering it, and in fact it advances it at the same time as making it accessible. It's not like an either or where you take a little away from transcendence to get a little more grasp on it. It's not like that. You know, it's something much more, I don't know the right word, I guess the title, it's much more radical. That's the religious side. I think on the philosophical side, with the Neoplatonic tradition, which has a very rich conceptual and theoretical, it's a very rich conceptual tradition. It has a lot of resources in its own on its own terms that for Breton are always coming into contact with the Christian side of himself or the theological side I don't want to separate the Christian side and the not, and that wouldn't make much sense for Breton and understanding him. Because for him to be a Neoplatonist is to be a Christian thinker in the best sense. But on the Neoplatonic side, I think the radicality of the transcendence, and it's you know, for the pagan Neoplatonists, the highest form of what they call hymning the divine, H-Y-M-N, hymning the divine, is sige, or silence. You know, it's like this sense that, you know, this sort of rapt attention, intellectual sort of attention to the absolute. St. Augustine would say something like, I can never speak adequately of God, therefore I have to never stop speaking, kind of idea. And that's a loose quote from Augustine, the Neoplatonist Augustine. And so the tradition, and it's philosophical, and it's theological, and it's religious, and it's, I don't know, what would you call, it's theoretical science, has all these resources to help with that. I think that Breton's, I think he's happy to allow it to be a difficulty. I think that's really an important part of it. That's probably the last word there. Yeah.
I was going to ask, does he have a task? His task appears to be to sort of re-imbue our thought in an intellectual Pauline sense with the peculiarity and radicality of Christianity, but Christianity is seen from this both intellectual and passionate sense to sort of bring that about. Would you say that maybe that's his task? I mean, I saw a lot of unification as his task, but like I'd never quite put my finger on what it was he wanted to reunify.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting thing. And to me, it's a challenging question. What is he unifying? What has been, and if you're unifying something, what has been sort of dispersed or separated? Or and one way to think about that is himself. I mean, and what I mean by that is, in the Neoplatonic tradition, when you unify the self, you discover yourself by being drawn to this transcendent origin of all things. So the origin and the end of all things is one. All things, there's the idea of exitus, everything comes from the one, and there's this task of returning to the one. And returning to the one is a phrase this Neoplatonists use. It's synonymous with returning to the self, to yourself. That's what's very Platonist in that sense. What I am is this. My place in reality is found in their language in union with the one, or contemplation of the one, or intellectual rapt attention, absorbed attention into the one. You know, it's like that's where the fullness of whatever I am happens. But so there's a that duality. So you're drawn closer to the divine. You discover the self. And not in Breton's term, in Breton's sense. It doesn't mean that the self is divine, you know, that the self is what I am as a creature, but I discover myself in this, I don't know, connection with, communion with, loving, words break down here, but you know what I'm saying? In relation to the divine, I discover what I am. And I become more myself by becoming more like the divine.
Would that for him be where almost like an eidetic phenomenological reduction actually comes in some form, that there's always something of that sort going on? You know, as you said before, he takes one thing and spirals out as far as he can. Yeah. The phenomenological reduction of, you know, what is this thing that we're both struggling to describe in terms of this relationship, the one and the self? You know, phenomenology would say like, you just keep going into it and making some attempt.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's always, I think for Breton, it's a task. Philosophy is a task which is always a failure, but that's its success. You know, it's like the old thing that Socrates saw when he went into the temple of Apollo, written above the door, mortal, know thyself. You know, you're entering into the domain of the immortal, and you are mortal. You know, that's the sort of Socrates takes that in his own way, but it captures just a sort of, I don't know, a basic sense of our own mortality in relationship to what's higher. And I think the wonder of it for Breton is that that doesn't destroy us; it awakens us. It's something that holds, brings us into being, and holds us in being, in reality. And it's a, it's that's the vision of the new God or whatever the way he puts it. And it's kind of a misleading phrase, but it's his words that the cross reveals.
Do you think any of this could have, you know, what would this philosophy even be without religion for Breton? I guess that's almost a silly question. Couldn't be.
No, not for Breton. And even the Neoplatonists, to say it's a philosophy, to oppose philosophy and religion or religiosity or mysticism or however you want to articulate this is a misunderstanding of what philosophy is, what human being is, what it means to be human. And that's the sort of, that's the great enigma. And for some reason, Breton, Catholic priest, Passionist priest, thought that Neoplatonism was, and a lot of people, and if we're serious that this is, if it is right to say Neoplatonism is the spiritual grammar of the West, then Breton's not alone in this. For some, somehow it gives us great resources and insight into understanding the enigma of ourselves. You know, it's a very vibrant philosophy in the greatest sense, in the best sense. Anyway.
I guess in that sense, did he ever comment on the rise of, you know, atheism and secularity, I guess, post-World War II? Because 1912 to 2005, I mean,
Yeah, he's seen a lot.
he's really seeing the, I guess, well, he wouldn't be seeing the peak, but I mean, in 1900 is probably the peak of collective universal faith in the West, I guess. And then through to 2005, seeing the beginnings of the world we now accept, quote unquote, accept as the norm. I mean, did he ever comment on this?
Yes, I think Breton has a unique perspective on it. I mean, I think the events, for example, of late May 68, you know, in Paris and in France more broadly, those left a big mark on his thinking. I think he is very much of that era. He's one who sort of celebrates, in a way, the critical dimension of that, the good use of, you know, bringing down structures of purific, you know, he sees it almost in a purific, in a ascetic sense. You know, it's, you know, Christendom of the Age of Ages past is not, he does, has no nostalgia for that. His only interest is in fidelity to, and whatever that means, you know, it doesn't mean fidelity to Christ and his teaching is to put what he called the basileia to Theo, the kingdom of God in first place. And to do that is to give you the, to liberate you from a concern with, you know, saving the West or, you know, that may be an implication or sort of an, something that happens as a consequence of true fidelity to Christ's teaching and ethic and the reign of, the conviction that charity ultimately will rule all things. That may be very well be a consequence, or it may not. You know, it's not something that Breton's worried about. I think for him, it's very much, it's an important aspect of his thinking that liberates him to see things like Marxist critique has some sort of value in criticizing economic and political injustice or something, you know, that it has some value. It liberates him to not have this anxiety about what's been lost. It's an eschatological orientation. And by eschatology, I don't mean flight from the world and letting the world burn, because it's a conviction that, as in the words of Christ at the end of the book of Revelation, behold, I make all things new. That's the sort of, it's everything, you know, that's the sort of radicality of the Christian faith that I think you, if you don't see it directly in the words of Breton, Some places you do, you see it right behind, supporting his thinking, supporting the sort of passion of his writing. Behold, I make all things new is sort of the, you know, charity is going to rule. There's going the creation will be transfigured. And right now it's just a seed kind of idea. It's this true Christian religious conviction, gospel conviction of Breton's that liberates him to not worry, not worry. You know, so he's trying to like the Sermon on the Mount kind of stuff, you know, don't worry.
It is very Pauline because it reminds me, you know, when we read the Gospels, you'd realize that the apostles, many of them were very, not necessarily confused, but a bit befuddled about the idea of this king. I mean, what kind of king is he going to be?
Yeah, yeah.
This is Pilate's great quandary of, well, can I call him a king? What kind of king is he? And then as he dies, they're not still not really sure. Like, but hang on, he was meant to be the king. Why is he not ruled, et cetera, and things like this. And then I think with Paul, now correct me if I'm wrong, I'm still, you know, I'm still a baby Catholic, but
we all are.
with Paul, I think you finally see that, look, let's get down to brass tacks and talk about really the kingdom of God over the kingdom of the world, you know, the king of all nations, the king of heaven above and not the king of the world sort of thing. And then finally, Paul is really the first to say, look, with that intellectual rigor to start putting it down of you guys are still really focused on what we just told you not to focus on. And it's back to this beyond thing, right?
Yes. I think there's what you could call the eschatological difference, you know, is something that, and again, Neoplatonism is a useful tool. And I think the right way to understand from St. Paul to, contemporary, like Breton, near contemporaries, is that the right way for a Christian or Catholic thinker to relate to these systems, like, you know, whether it's I don't know, philosophy deriving from the Upanishads, or is this philosophy deriving from Neoplatonism, or if it's Stoicism, or, you know, all these different systems of and religious values and systems in the world, Confucianism and so on. By the way, all this, like even Neoplatonism, it feels like a lot, sort of an untapped resource still. It's very vibrant. The same can be said about the way to gratefully use these systems of thought to sort of understand more fully, the gospel. I think that, so anyway, So, back to your question, really sort of took us on a little bit of a detour there, but for him, it's not a matter of let's rearticulate the idea again, and let's jump back into it. Sorry,
that Breton has this Pauline disposition, and that.
Yes,
he's Paul. You know, Paul is the first person to really, I guess, intellectually begin the intellectual tradition of Christianity. Not saying that the apostles didn't, but beginning with that. Let's take the absence that you mentioned earlier, the absence in the tomb. Let's take this absence and this kingdom of God above, this thing that we can't see, this unintelligibility in a way, the thing that we're both struggling to articulate here. Let's take this somehow intellectually seriously. And Paul begins in a very simple way, I think, in just rearticulating the teachings of Christ in an intellectual manner.
Yes. Yeah. No, Paul understood himself, you know, as a quote unquote apostle to the Gentiles, you know, so he's willing to, this is where I was going. Sorry. He's willing to use, and this becomes a method of patristics, medievals, and guys like Breton to utilize concepts, theories, dispositions, values that are out, that are available in order to better articulate the vision. And that vision, you could say, is never fully completely articulated until all of that's incorporated as the sort of expansive feature of, and so we're just sort of, when they say we're all baby Catholics, it's in a sense the church is a baby, you know, the Christian mission is a baby, the vision, the Christian intellectual vocation that Breton's such a great representative of is in its infant stages, you know, we're just at the beginning here, is I think a sentiment that Breton would share. But you're right, for St. Paul, you could think of him as the first theologian because he's will use concept and theory borrowed from philosophies, ready-made ideas that have a life outside of, that are born like in Stoicism or something, that are used in the Pauline letters, in his letters, to express more adequately what he wants to teach to his communities that he's founded and is sort of nourishing. And that's a practice, that idea of right use. For the Greeks, it's called orthe krasis. For the Latins, it was called usus iustus. It's a right use is sort of a method that defines, you could say, the Christian or Catholic intellectual practice. And you see it right there in Breton with Neoplatonism, or with Marxism, or with phenomenology, or in the scholastic mode with Aristotle. But none of those is adequate for Breton. None of those is adequate in itself. All the best it can do is shed a unique and crucial feature. If it's valuable and useful, it can shed light on a facet of the mystery, to use a traditional word, of the mystery of ourselves, of God, and the world. But it's incomplete without, it's ever only incomplete.
Mm. So his whole task is almost a self-awareness of the fact that there is this task, but it will never be complete. But the task is just to continue this strange, passionate march towards the beyond.
Yeah, the ineffable, or you know, and that which he uses all these images like the desert, the zero, really rich, interesting, the principle, nothing is one of his favorites. Nothing by excess, or nothing par excellence, or the creative nothing. These are all mystical terms for the divine reality that in the Neoplatonic tradition. He uses all these images to help us get in that mystical space, I guess, that mystical intellectual space where he thinks the best thinking is going to happen. That's why the idea of the principle, is so profound and difficult, but so fundamental to him.
Mm. How is this all received? You know, in the intellectual current of the day, is he received well, or, you know, is there much of a legacy?
Breton. There's a legacy. I mean, I've been to conferences on Breton. There's thinkers far and wide that read his thought. Catholic continental type people, you know, interested in continental thought, that's interested in French philosophy or the Renaissance of Neoplatonism in France. Thinkers who, yeah, he's a breath of fresh air. And I think people do recognize that. I think Breton, because he's so, I mean, he wrote 40 books, like 200 articles plus. I mean, the guy, I don't know, he slept with a pencil stylus in his hand. You know, I don't know what he's doing, but he's very.
He's just French. That's what they all do.
Yeah. Very prolific. But he's writing about, you know, he's got, you know, three or four books on mysticism. He's got three or four books. His first publications are on Hartmann. He's got a book on Hartmann too, which was his second thesis in France. He's got a book on Aquinas. He's got three or four books on Neoplatonism, mathematics and Proclus, matter and dispersion, in the Neoplatonic sense. He's got three books on Marxism, and on and on. You know, it's he's difficult too. When you get into his like systematic type, I mean, even the word in the cross, he's got this style of writing that is not fluffy, you know, it's dense, I think. And when you get in particular to his systematic sort of treatise type, big fat treatise type works, and not even huge, but like Du Principe or Etre au Monde Imaginaire, the sort of core philosophical texts of his, you know, people, you know, there's a bit off-putting, you know, you're gonna have to invest a lot of energy into getting to the bottom of what he's doing. But it's coming around, you know, the Poetics of the Sensible is another work of his. It's been translated and it should be coming out next year. So that'll be number 4 in English.
Which one did I miss?
Let's see. We said Word on the Cross.
Radical Philosophy of St. Paul.
Radical Philosophy of St. Paul. Oh, sorry. That'd be number 3, wouldn't it? Sorry. Yeah. Poetics of the Sensible is number 3. Yeah, that'd be the 3rd in English. But we're still waiting for for more to happen. I mean, it's yeah, I don't know. In a way, you know, the studies of Breton are sort of at their beginnings, you know. Talking about always a new beginning of thinking. I think that Breton's work has a future.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in theological works.
Yeah, you'd advise people to begin with that interview at the back of the Word of the Cross.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the best places to start. I think Word on the Cross as a whole is a great place. It presumes a lot of the reader, but it's worth it. Mm-hmm. I think the little thing I translated with, I tried to give sort of recently in a journal, a particular examination, really brief. It's about the cross and the principle, these two ideas that have some resonance, but they're also in conflict in his thought. You know, they're not, you can't reduce one to the other. I think that's sort of a late stage reflection of his. I think it was like 1988 that he did it. One of the last things he did. I think that's a great place to start too, if you're interested in what Neoplatonism means to him and its relationship to his, I don't know, cross spirituality theology side. I think that there's also a really useful article from 1979 mm-hmm. by a guy named Dan Valiancourt, called The World of Stanislaus Breton. It's a really long article. A lot of the biographical stuff that I may have mentioned is found there. That's another English text. There's a lot. There's probably 8 or 9 articles of his in English mm-hmm. that you can find. Several on phenomenology, if that's people's interest. He's very brilliant. I mean, he's not afraid of conceptual rigor. But he's also not afraid of having a poetic sensibility too. So I love that union.
Is there works you sort of wish were translated that are more poetic? Is there any works where he maybe writes almost as a mystic?
He sort of shade into that some. I mean, he's got a book called Nothing or Something, a metaphysical novel. I was reading something recently that was praising that for its literary poetic style. I think there are passages in The Word on the Cross and in A Radical Philosophy of St. Paul in which his, I wouldn't call it mystical, but his religiosity really rises to the top. And the sort of radicality of the whole thing that he wants to keep fresh and alive and burning emerges. But even, you know, what's interesting, like Du Principe, On the Principle, or Being World Imaginary, those two philosophical tomes of his, which, by the way, have no footnotes, no references to any other thinker. They're like, they're meant to be this sort of rigorous, complete. They're meant to imitate Euclid's work, you know, where you divide all mathematics you devise from this sort of fundamental axioms. He proceeds that way, kind of like what Proclus does in Elements of Theology. He's trying to imitate Euclid. I mean, these fundamental axioms or this one fundamental principle by which you drive this entire system. He does that in those works. There's a certain dryness, you could say. It's probably not the best word, and rigor to the whole thing. But when you get the feel of it, and you start to get immersed into it, there's a certain mystical dimension to it. You know, it's like you're going to read St. Thomas Aquinas. Ooh, it's going to, you know, you're going to be, you know, distinctions and questions and concepts. And, you know, there's a certain dry systematicity to it. It's pretty awe-inspiring. I mean, a mind could do that. At the same time, there's this sort of sense and awareness of the ineffable, you know, that this mystical dimension, even in that place, in the desert. So like one of his Breton's favorite ideas is that the desert blooms. The desert grows. Both Nietzsche and Heidegger use that language. They like that phrase, but he uses it in a different way from them. That's a place where this expanse, the boundless vastness of emptiness, is a place where there's a paradoxical and dryness. There's this sort of paradoxical sense of richness and overflow and wealth that's not of this world kind of idea. I think that really suffuses even his driest, most rigorous works.
Okay. Is
So
there any?
hopefully those will be translated one day.
Well, I hope so. Of all the things they're doing with artificial intelligence, I hope one day they actually just
Yeah,
nestle
we could do that,
down.
couldn't we?
I think we could, right? Scan them
Yeah.
all in, they analyze it or something. I don't know. It doesn't seem that that would be too complicated at this point.
Right, I know. We could do it. We could certainly do it. It'd be great.
Is there anything you'd like to add about Breton you feel we have covered?
I think we hit the Neoplatonism stuff really well. I think, well, you know, one of the things that is really worth thinking about, I think would be interesting to a lot of people, would be the way in which he talks about the imperative of narrative understanding, like mythos, myth, and its relationship to logos or rationality. So, or the poetic or the symbolic, and its relationship to concept. And to have a fully human, fully radical philosophy, and this is really repeating what Plato did and said, is, you know, in Plato's work, for example, and I think this is echoed in Breton, particularly in Being, World, and in the Imaginary, where whenever logos reaches its sort of limits, Plato, and that where and it reaches its limits in a certain place. Whenever it reaches its limits, he turns to myth. He tells a story. And where it runs, it's a story about the beginning of things, where we come from, or the end of things, where we're going. So you think about the myths, like at the in certain the end of certain works of his, the Republic or the Gorgias or whatever. He turns to he recognizes that conceptuality has these limitations, that somehow the mythic order or the narrative order, which has sort of preceded the birth of rationality. Humans have been understanding by way of story for millennia longer than we have through concept and theory. And that's the milieu, that's the womb in which philosophy was born. That's the appropriate setting for philosophical, intellectual, conceptual understanding. And it's that place where it flourishes most, like the soil in which it should be placed. That's Plato, and I think it's also Breton. He makes arguments like that, not in those words, in Being, World, Imaginary, as this logos and mythos, and there's these two ways that have to be, they come into conflict, but they also, and through that conflict and that relation, that difficult, like fraternal relation, they are, understanding is deepened or expanded. And I think in that sense, he's recovering something that is certainly lost in our understanding of what philosophy is meant to be. That's why we were saying earlier that, you know, Philosophy 101 class is not going to give you the Plato like that. It's going to think of philosophy according to this weird modern myth of what philosophy is, in which it sheds off, it emerges from mythos and just gets rid of it. You know, it's part of our own, it's just sort of, you know, that's sort of, you know, Enlightenment sort of kind of thinking about what understanding is. Breton promoted a more truly Platonic conception. And in that sense, hopefully, a more fully human understanding of what understanding is. You have narrative mode and theoretical intelligence too, but they're not separate. They're distinct and in some kind of tension, but they're also coordinated and necessarily related.
Why do you think it is we do cut them off now? Just for ease? There's like a depth, there's a depth of, if you enter into myth, all of a sudden you have to begin to have a dialogue with a lot of other things as well.
Like religion.
Exactly.
Yeah, like religion. I think it's a part of the modern secular experiment, you know, the desire for Western civilization and and most influential figures in the Enlightenment era, in awe at the success of the scientific method, and a desire to see that amazing success replicated outside of the experiment room, outside of the laboratory, and replicated for politics, for philosophy, for for everything else, for culture, and sort of having a unified humanity that doesn't have to worry about these competing visions of a transcendent good, you know, that bring a lot of conflict into the world. Now, I would argue, and it has been argued by many, that that ambition, and that, well, so that, that's what we're, so the, I'm trying to connect that to this desire to get rid of myth, narrative understanding as a place in which, the greatest place in which a vision of transcending, a vision of the good by which we can live together, can exist. And so they replace it with, you know, with a desire to, well, they try to just eclipse it altogether, I suppose. So it is really part of a program for, this is sort of the Western, where Western civilization is a result of that. One way of thinking where we are today is a result of that desire to be done with a transcendent vision of the good, which is accessed beyond concept and theory, but not without them, but beyond them in narrative and myth. But all that is its own myth. You know, everybody says that, you know, from Blumenberg on, that's its own story about truth, mm-hmm. and the good. And we don't need a transcendent vision of the good to live well. We just need everybody to, this is a liberal, in terms of the liberal vision out of Locke, we just need everybody to agree to pursue our own goods ourselves. And we need to protect people to do that. And that's where our happiness will be found. And by happiness, I mean, you know, a state of flourishing. You know, on the other hand, you have Marxism, which has said something like, well, that's a problem right there. And I know the problems of that really well. There's going to be the haves and the have-nots, and the haves are going to just keep getting more and more at the expense of those without. That's unjust. So Marx will say, well, the vision of the good is this utopic future, which everything's ordered to and moving ineluctably towards. I am an instrument of that activity by doing what we have to do to get to, I don't know, spread the wealth around, you know, that everybody can have. But it's still a vision of, so you have these competing visions of the good that are behind any order.
And you need the good that's beyond, or something that's beyond the good altogether.
You need, yeah. Well, the good beyond, it's, you know, it's for the Christians, it's the kingdom of God. It's the mm-hmm. new creation. It's the behold, I make all things new. It's the, what Easter morning signifies, mm-hmm. you know, this conquest of death and so on. And partaking of that life to come now it's for the world. It's not a flight from the world. That's that vision that we can't bring about ourselves is the best way for humanity to tap into all that's good and beautiful and true. That's the Christian sort of, I don't know, that's what Christians have to say to the political order. That's what Christians have to say to economics. That's what Christians have to say. It's this vision of the kingdom, you know, that the charity will rule all things. But it's a transcendent vision. It's accessed most fully through story, through myth, through narrative, you know, and that's the form for the Christians. That's the form, the primary form of revelation, mm-hmm. is a story.
Parable.
Parable. But that's set within a wider story, and it's all one story from beginning to end. You know, it's a transcendent vision. It's, anyway, I'm getting carried away and all this stuff, but that's an important aspect of understanding mm-hmm. that Plato held, that Breton really seems to hold, and it has a lot to say to not only the world of yesterday, but also to today.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Breton was trying to do.
Yeah. I think that's a pleasant place to finish up. I feel we've covered a lot of ground, and hopefully some people will be drawn to Breton. So, Chris Hackett, yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, James.